is Zane versus Barnes, case number 67219.
This case arises out of the application of an excessively strong acetic acid solution during a surgery that was performed at Southern Hills Medical Center. The solution was prepared and provided by employees of Southern Hills and its pharmacy. It was applied by Dr. Zane during the operation. Suit was brought against Dr. Zane, MSCC, Southern Hills, its pharmacy, and several named employees involved in the preparation and transmission of the solution. The jury awarded $2 million in non-economic damages, and a little less than $250,000 in economic damages, which was subsequently reduced to about $160,000 by way of a deduction of charges that were written off and thus never incurred. On post-judgment motions that were filed timely pursuant to NRCP 6E, the district court made rulings that in total resulted in NSCC's liability being three times as great as Dr. Zane. And it is that discrepancy that I want to focus my arguments here this morning on.
Before you do, and I don't know if you're going to reach it, but I'm concerned about whether or not you made a Rule 50A motion as to your client, that is the entity in Nevada Cancer Surgical Center, whatever its initials are. The site that you give in your brief is a motion for JMOL on punitive damages and them being not available. I do not see where you made the 50A motion on the non-liability on a negligent hiring theory as to the entity defendant. Can you enlighten me on this?
Yes. In terms of a motion that was captioned NRCP 50A, there was no motion.
Right,
there was no motion. And what the plaintiff says is that you didn't make a directed verdict motion. And that is true. And the reason is because directed verdict motions no longer exist. We now have motions for judgment as a matter of law, of which what used to be called a directed verdict motion is one. Now, let me tell you why nothing that could be called a directed verdict motion was made. What was made was a summary judgment motion and a motion in limine. The motion in limine said the evidence that the plaintiff wants to rely on is is not competent and should not be admitted. The summary judgment motion said, as a matter of law, this claim cannot survive.
But you would agree that R50A is modeled on FRCP 50A, correct?
It is modeled on it.
And
there are some differences.
Okay, but under federal 50A, summary judgment does not preserve the 50A JMLL motion.
It doesn't, but here's the reason why. That argument, with all due respect, and this is the point.
Okay, tell me.
My point is this. If you have a ruling that denies summary judgment on the claim, and a ruling that says, with the evidence that you want to exclude is in fact admissible, and that evidence is admissible at trial, you cannot make a Rule 50A motion. Because a Rule 50A motion says there is insufficient evidence to take this claim to the jury. The judge has already said no, and he said no in two different ways. One, the evidence is admissible, and it's there. And he said that the claim is sufficient to go to the jury. So no directed verdict motion, that form of a judgment as a matter of law motion was made simply because if it had been, we would have been looking at Rule 11 violations square in the face.
But the summary judgment's interlocutory, as is the motion in limine, it would seem to me that you could certainly renew and say, 50A, I'm renewing my argument that there is no competent admissible evidence that supports the imposition of liability in this case. We deserve JMLL. That was not done.
That was not done. And I respectfully submit that because 50B, the commentary to 50B, says, you can renew a motion for judgment as a matter of law made before or at the time the case goes to the jury. But you don't have to make that 50A motion, which is, as you observe, simply a renewal of issues that the court has already resolved against you, and that resolution has resulted in the admission of evidence.
Do you have any cases from Nevada or federal court that would support your argument that your pretrial motions obviated the need for a 50A motion at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case?
I'm trying to remember. I think when this issue was raised in the district court, what we relied on was a Nevada comment to the Nevada.
Okay.
I can't say that for sure. It may well be that we did cite case law, but I think we relied on the comments to the Nevada rule.
Okay, I don't mean to derail your argument. I'm sorry to take so long with this.
You're here. The pleasure to hear. I want to focus initially on the ruling by which the district court denied the cap on non-economic damages to LSCC while affording it to Dr. Zan. And in that connection, there is one fundamental overriding truth that I would like this court to focus on throughout its consideration of this particular case. And that is, this truth is simply this. The conduct insofar as both Dr. Zhang and NSCC is concerned, the conduct that caused absolutely all of Mr. Barnes' damages was the conduct of Dr. Zhang in the operating room. Now, we have claims here for negligent hiring, training, supervision. The negligent hiring claim connects NSCC to Dr. Zhang's conduct in the operating room. It is possible, though there is no competent evidence of it whatsoever, it is possible, at least in theory, that the negligent hiring and training of Dr. Zhang, if it did occur, contributed to the malpractice that Dr. Zhang is alleged to have committed in the operating room that injured Dr. Zhang, that injured Mr. Barnes. I respectfully submit that in those circumstances, you simply cannot have liability on the part of the employer, the professional entity through whom Dr. Zhang practices, that is three times as great as Dr. Zhang's liability. Simple elementary principles of causation just simply don't allow that to occur. There are four reasons why the arguments that are made that say NSCC's liability is not, for non-economic damages, is not capped. Number one, in this court's recent TAM decision, the court clarified the cap applies, one cap applies per incident, regardless of the number of defendants or the number of claims in legal theories. And that's reflected in what happened here. There are negligent entrustment claims, yes, but what injured Dylan Barnes? It was Dr. Zhang's professional negligence in the operating. The second reason is this court's decision in Corral versus Perez, in which the court said that the relevant provisions of NRS Chapter 41 apply to the professional entity through whom a professionally licensed physician practices, but not because of the language of any Chapter 41 provisions, but because of the provisions of Chapter 89, the Professional Corporation and Association Statute. The third reason has to do the arguments that they present in their brief, they say, well, the claim for negligent hiring and training and supervision isn't a professional negligence claim because NSCC is not a provider of health care. Well, what does NSCC do? Of course they're not a provider of health care directly. It is provided through a life of licensed professionals, Dr. Zhang in this case. And that is why, with the exception of hospitals who operate under a very different regulatory scheme, that is all the listing of providers of health care is in the statutes. It's individuals, it's not entities.
Now, we have a little problem, though, in terms of the subsequent change by the legislature, which was done in 2015, that rolled them into health care, where previously they were not.
They were not named. Here's why I think the change occurred in the form to which you had referred. As the legislative history reflects, there were some district court decisions that would go so far as to say, well, you can avoid the cap on non-economic damages if you just sue the entity. You don't sue the doctor who is listed as a provider of health care. Most courts said, wait a minute, every entity in the world provides its services through people. But in order to make it absolutely crystal clear and end all controversy on this, they just simply listed the entities in the statute. So it was crystal clear you couldn't just sue the entity, as had been done. Now, it is clear both from the legislative history and from this court's TAM decision that is not a change. It is a clarification of the law.
Well, that clarification of the law, they would want to say that that provision of this act applied to causes of action that occurs on or after the effective date of the act. So they were very specific.
Yes, they were. And in terms of applicability, that's absolutely right. The question, however, is the effect of the legislature's action in terms of whether this was the law or is only the law after the effective date. And when you have the TAM decision, which repeatedly talks about this legislation being a clarification, that means the law wasn't this way. We're just clarifying.
Real quickly, because your time is getting away, why should we be concerned with the issue of insurance in this case, since both parties are all over and throwing the word out there?
Here's the problem. There are arguments made in the briefs about whose witnesses first mentioned the word insurance. And there is a dispute in the affidavits as to how the specific of the insurance, the policy declaration page, inadvertently got in front of the jury. But remember how strong the law is on this issue. A one question that reveals a payment from a collateral source. And the court has said the only remedy for collateral source is a new trial. Here, and the prejudice may cut both ways. It's not clear. The plaintiffs argue this as to how the prejudice worked. But the prejudice from the specific information with respect to policy limits, warrants a new trial.
I asked the question because it was a stipulated exhibit.
I know. It was a credential file, and in that file, and as I said, there's a debate as to why it was left in the file that went to the jury, was the declaration
for it. Chief, could I ask one question to follow up on that? Mr. Frederick, I was interested in that question on insurance. That's an issue I'm concerned about here in this case, but the scenario is unusual. You know, you have the exhibit that the parties stipulate to, it's admitted, so you have two attorneys. Each side made a mistake. The judge made a mistake letting them go in, you know, like in approving it. But we see how that happens in trials. I mean, judges, we probably don't look at every page when the two parties stipulate to it. So it happened. But since it was a mutual mistake by three different people here, that was my concern, is how do we have error on that? I mean, I've never seen that before in many cases this court's handled and I've handled over the years. And
I understand that. And I will be quite frank with you. If this court had not said that the mere question that somebody received a paycheck is enough to require a new trial, I would recognize the kinds of things you're talking about. There is lawyer mistakes, judicial mistakes. There's no question this got to the jury by inadvertence. But it is the specifics of the insurance information that I think warrants a new trial.
Thank you.
I would like to, I hope to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick, for your argument. Mr. Schnitzer.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Schnitzer, and I'm with Gary Schnitzer, represents Dylan Barnes. There's one simple way to resolve all of the issues before this court, and that is to enforce EDCR 8.06. And if you enforce EDCR 8.06, there's no discretion to give the defendants 3 days from mailing to file a motion for new trial and motion to amend. The defendants' motions for new trial and motion to amend were untimely, requiring that the original judgment as entered must be reinstated. EDCR 8.06 explicitly states that no time is added for mailing with regard to a motion for new trial or motion to amend. There's no dispute about that. The motion for new trial or motion to amend are outside of the time with which to file.
Does that supersede your MCP?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Why? One's a district court rule, the other is Supreme Court rule.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The rule was enacted by the Supreme Court. In fact, it was signed off by all the justices standing from me. And the rule itself says it is enforced notwithstanding any other rule of this court. So I believe that that language is abrogating 6E and intentionally to the rules for the Judicial District Court.
Do you concede that there's a conflict between 6E and the BDCR?
It absolutely conflicts.
What do you do with Rule 83 that says the rules of civil procedure control?
It says rules of civil procedure control overrule enacted by the local district courts. That's not what happened here. This was actually a rule that signed off by the Supreme Court. And all the justices are confirming it today. And so for that reason, where 1806 says, notwithstanding any other rule of this court, it aggregates it.
Mr. Schnitzer, I think the whole court rules are signed off by the Supreme Court, whether they're local rules, Nevada District Court rules. So I'm not sure I agree with that analysis. I mean, the district court cannot enact court rules, only the Supreme Court can. So how would you respond to that?
So I would respond to that in this case, the rules say that the district court can make rules on their own, but they can't conflict with the rules of civil procedure. In this case, the Judicial District Court petitioned the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court signed off on the rules. And the rules state, not seeing any other rule of this court. And my interpretation of that is that it is superseding NRCP 6E, because it comes after 6E was already enacted.
Well, let's say that we don't agree with you on that issue. Let's talk about the insurance that went before the jury. So let's say that this court finds that it's definitely error. We don't care who committed the error. It sounds like everybody committed error in this case. And how do we sustain a verdict if, in fact, there's error like this? How do we write it?
Sure. Well, I think what you have to have is you have to have an abuse of discretion. That's what we're looking for. There must be palpable abuse and there must show injustice. And there's no injustice in this case. The insurance, as you know, was first discussed during the voir dire with no objection. And the defendants first raised the issue of insurance. The owners of the practice said it twice. She first said her expectation in hiring someone is they would be able to get malpractice insurance. And then she said, you can't hire someone who can't be insured. Both of these statements support the judge's discretion and decision. If there was an error in this case, it's invited error because the defendants in this case brought it upon themselves. And for that reason, it's not a proper subject for review on appeal. After Dr. McBride's comments, the defendants initially asked for a mistrial. They say it basically forces us to ask for a mistrial. Then Mr. Vogel withdraws it. The judge says, I don't want a mistrial. And Mr. Vogel says, I don't want one either. So I think they've actually weighed that argument as well. Even if there was the admission of insurance and we think it's improper, the majority view is now that evidence of liability insurance is really prejudicial. The appropriate step is to rectify that by mentioning with a limiting instruction. The district court twice offered a limiting instruction in this case. They offered that the time insurance was mentioned by Dr. McBride, and we actually offered a jury instruction limiting it. They objected to that, and the judge sustained the objection. So twice they were offered a limiting instruction, and both times they rejected it. So that's another reason we believe they waived their appeal rights on the insurance issue.
Now, what about a final jury instruction on that, where the judge would have complete discretion to give an instruction to abandon any talk about the insurance?
Absolutely, and that's what we offered. And I believe it's a form instruction that we offered to ignore any possibility of insurance, because most people nowadays know that there's liability insurance, and we offered that to the judge, and the judge did not give it.
What was his reason for that?
To be honest, I don't remember. I think he said the defendants don't want it. They think it'd be more harmful than helpful. And so we offered it, and they didn't want it, so I don't think they can stand here before you today and say there was error when they rejected limiting instruction.
But I thought the discussion about the limiting instruction was in the context of the defendant's witness who testified about the credentialing requirements, but not in the context of the exhibit that actually ended up in the jury room.
Correct. And that was the first time, Your Honor.
Well, there's quite a bit of difference between the limiting instruction that says, well, a doctor who mentions that we want someone to be insured as a credentialing requirement versus placing the deck sheet in the jury, don't you think?
No, there's absolutely a difference. And there were two chances for the limiting instruction. The first was right after the mention of insurance, and the jury instruction itself was very general. That said, you might have to consider
why I did that. But no one knew, apparently, when they were talking about that instruction, that the exhibit contained the deck sheet, and it ended up in the jury room. And
three jurors talked about it later.
Absolutely, and I don't think the jury instruction itself would change, even if we had known that beforehand. The jury instruction says you have to consider whether any party has insurance or whether...
But the refusal, the disinclination to accept a limited instruction, I think Justice Hardesty's point is, arose in the context of a witness's mention in passing of somebody's certification, they need to be able to be certified, they need to get hospital privileges, they need to be insurable, blah, blah, limited instruction, no, yes, maybe. But then it goes to the jury room with the deck sheet, and there's no, the horse has left the barn at that point. It wasn't known until the jury came back, right, that there was that problem with the exhibit.
And I don't know when the defendants knows that.
There was no renewed discussion of a limiting instruction, nor could there have been one effectively given.
The jury deliberated for 4 or 5 days. I don't know when the defendants realized the insurance was in there.
How was it brought to the court's attention?
The defendants brought it to the court's attention after the jury rendered its verdict. So I don't know if they were holding on to that to find out what the verdict was going to be before they raised the issue or not.
It's a cipher. The record, you're just speculating at this point.
Yeah, I don't know.
So the record tells that there was polling of the jurors? Isn't that how it was discovered?
No. It was, they spoke to the jurors after the fact, not in open court. But with respect to that exhibit, the district, it's important to realize the district court found the defendants were the ones that used and relied upon that exhibit. The district court noted the party were given the opportunity to review the exhibits before they were given to the jury. So to have that chance to review it and then complain that you missed something, you didn't like something that goes in, it amounts to invited error. Any error in Exhibit 32 is their responsibility. They can't use their own mistake as a basis for a new trial.
Justice Pickering engaged in a discussion with Mr. Frederick over the issue of the procedural question involving a motion for a directed verdict or a motion under 50A or 50B. You obviously welcome to comment yourself about the procedural aspect of that.
Sure.
What I'd like you to talk about, though, in addition, is if this court were to conclude that that procedural impediment has either been satisfied or doesn't exist, what's the basis for the negligent hiring training liability in this case, and why wouldn't the cap extend to that entity?
Sure. Let me first say, I obviously agree with Justice Pickering's position, but subsequently...
That's not my position,
I'm questioning my comment.
Yeah, it's all right.
No, it's fair game. I just...
It's a conversation. I don't think she's voted yet.
Absolutely. In terms of the substance of the claims.
Sure. Do you have anything else you want to add on the procedural question?
No, we certainly believe that they've made the right for a directed verdict. The directed verdict was only sought as to punitive damages. I don't believe a motion for summary judgment qualifies because things change from summary judgment phase to trial. And so the directed verdict is to see what happened at trial and was the evidence that was actually presented to the jury sufficient. And so that's why I
believe. But you agree that the judge made two determinations. First, that the claim was cognizable, and secondly, that the evidence was sufficient.
He absolutely
and admissible, excuse me.
He absolutely said the evidence was admissible, and he absolutely said
so it was enough. So let me offer this, and maybe the rule itself is the problem, but in the context of a criminal case, we have held that a rule on a motion in limine sufficiently preserves that issue for appeal. Why shouldn't the court look at this question in a similar vein?
Well, I think we have to look at the rule as it's written, number one. Number two, I think it's different because the motion in limine simply says what evidence can and cannot come before the jury. The motion for directed verdict looks at what evidence actually came before the jury. And so they're two different issues, very different issues.
I do want to hear on the second part of Justice Hardesty's question, what supports your negligent hiring claim in that we get past the Rule 50 issue, and secondly, on whether or not why we shouldn't apply the cap
sure.
To the entity defendant. That's a concern.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So with respect to the negligent hiring claim, they acknowledge Dr. McBride was an expert in hiring, training, and supervising doctors. They acknowledge that Dr. McBride testified that MSCC felt well the standard of care in hiring, training, and supervising Dr. Zhang. All the cases that they cite deal with standard of care, which we have here. None of the cases they cite deal with causation. Proving causation doesn't mean you need to show it was a direct or only cause, only that it was a substantial factor in bringing about the harm. And we have that here. The expert opinion, Dr. McBride's expert opinion, was not required to show MSCC's actions contributed to Dr. Zhang's actions, which Dr. McBride testified caused the injuries. As long as the harm is foreseeable, it's a jury question. And so we've got Dr. McBride saying they fell within the standard of care, and so the causation in terms of did their failure to hire, train, and supervise them properly lead to his actions, which he did testify led to the injuries. That issue is a jury question.
For what testimony was there to address the training with respect to the use of this and application of this acid, acetic acid, during the course of a procedure like this? And how did Dr. Zhang fail to apply it or insert it or use it or determine the quantity correctly? I mean,
so was there any testimony about training on acid? What there was testimony is Dr. Zhang started immediately before this. He had several negative reviews, including not always being prepared in the operating room, arriving late for procedures, not paying attention to details, like not noticing something is 100% instead of 5%, tendency to ignore problems or sweep them under the rug, like when he applied the second dose of acid when he realized there was a problem with the first one, poor communication, like asking for general acetic acid instead of 5%, poor knowledge base. He claimed at trial that he didn't know acid came in 100% strength, and poor decision-making skills, which happened throughout the course of this treatment. And so Dr. McBride talked about all those things, and if you're hiring someone who has all these issues, you need to stay on them, you need to train them, and you need to supervise them. None of that happened. Dr. Zhang was essentially given free reign to go ahead and start practicing with no policies and procedures from his employer. And so on that basis, we believe there was sufficient evidence to support the negligent hiring, training, and supervision claim.
But was there testimony that a physician who's engaged in this procedure and is about to apply this acetic acid apparently as part of the procedure supposed to verify the quantity that has been requested?
Absolutely. So the doctor should say that.
Okay.
Including Dr. Zane's own anesthesiologist, who said he should have checked it.
Okay.
Why under Fairley should we not treat the entity defendant as a provider of health care? And I understand that the statute as written did not enumerate a practice group such as that, but provider of health care seems to encompass that, just those three words. And under Fairley, certainly, which gets overruled partially in Egan, but under Fairley, it seems like that's where the court was going.
I think Fairley is wrong in as much that it applies to the corporate actors. Even Fairley's right, it's different because 41.017 is not limited to providers of health care. It says any medical malpractice claim. 41.035 says it's only related to claims against a health care provider. So I think there's a difference even if it's not wrong. I'll be running out of time.
We interrupted your comment. I'll give you an extra minute to wrap up your comment, and Mr. Frederick was also interrupted, and give him a minute on rebuttal. And I think you both have done a good job of covering the issues here. Unless my colleagues have questions,
But I am interested in the point he was just addressing.
Yeah, so go right ahead, please.
So 41.035 only applies to actions against a healthcare provider for professional negligence. The TAM case references the cap on all actions against healthcare providers. MSCC is not a healthcare provider. MSCC is not included in the definition of healthcare provider. And the statutory maxim that the inclusion of one thing is the exclusion of another must apply here. And the maxim is consistent with the district court's ruling that MSCC is not protected by the cap.
But if your theory is they negligently hired and supervised this doctor, how could it not be the healthcare provider? Because the liability springs from the provision of healthcare by an employee. It's a riddle to me.
If you look at the Mitchell case by this court, there's actually a distinction between medical malpractice and negligent hiring, retraining, and supervision. They're distinct and separate claims against the healthcare provider. They're not medical malpractice
claims. But Mitchell is a privilege issue. If I have the right case in mind, it had to do with attorney-client privilege and a waiver on it, and chief, indulge me if you will. I just am having trouble seeing how you can have somebody sued on a theory that they negligently supervised a physician who injured your client, and then turn around and say, well, they're not a provider of healthcare or a healthcare provider for purposes of liability.
that's the statute as it was written.
Yeah, the statute's very awkward.
And you have to apply, the statute's very clear, it's unambiguous, and you have to apply it as it's written. It's clear that they didn't like how it was written and they wanted to change it, and so that was done in 2015. But you can't use a future statute to clarify what has already occurred. In fact, I think the amendment came about because of an unpublished decision by this court in McQuay, actually because of this case, because the personal attorney for relapsing cancer care was actually going to testify. And so to the extent that the amendment is meant to clarify, I think that that is a separation of powers, because you can't retroactively aggregate the decision and move forward.
Okay, Mr. Schutzer, any other questions? All right, thank you. Mr. Frederick, you went just a little bit over, so 2 minutes, sir.
Two quick points. One of them with respect to your exchange and with respect to both the procedural and the substantive aspects of this. Keep in mind that once the motion in limine is denied, the evidence comes in. I submit that when the evidence comes in over an objection that has already been made, you can most definitely appeal from the admission of that evidence, and you can challenge the sufficiency of the claim on which it is supposedly applicable to. That's the appeal right, and to deny it based upon the failure to make a motion that would have challenged the sufficiency of the evidence that is already in simply defeats the appeal from the judge's earlier rulings that have allowed that evidence to come in. Now let's go to the substantive question. And I think the best way to approach that is the one thing that the plaintiffs consistently try to avoid until this argument. And even then, the only thing said about causation here is, well, it's a substantial factor. But the problem is, it doesn't matter for cap purposes and for your claim, Justice Pepper, about liability. It doesn't matter that you call this a negligent hiring, training, and supervision claim if the causation of the plaintiff's injury comes about by way of a professional negligence claim against the professionally licensed person. And to say, as was said here at the very end, that, well, they're not listed in the statute, they aren't as entities because we don't license professional associations and corporations. We license people. And it is people who provide the health care on behalf of the entity.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Frederick. Mr. Schutzer, thank you for your arguments and your briefs. Well done. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until this afternoon at 2 p.m. Thank you.